Thank you very much indeed to all our speakers for that. We now have half an hour before you're allowed a drink. It's sent to you to have some really great observations, questions, whatever you want to do. Whilst you're just thinking of that, let me just draw your attention to a Comres poll published at the weekend for The Independent and the Sunday Mirror. And it offered various options for raising taxes to balance the books and so on. 45% supported increasing all rates of income tax by a penny, 44% opposed. But when it came to increasing national insurance for the self-employed, a mere 32% were in favour compared with 54% firmly against. So fascinating that actually the generality of people seem a little more prepared to pay the tax, but they still think that they could get away with it. So, with that, let me hand over to you. Some questions.
Thank you. I'm Jonathan Lowell, Jack Barrister. It seems to me that the gaps that insurance targets have the potential for influencing the way and consulting the user. What is not clear to me is whether they take account of the deductions for national insurance and other costs that employers receive. Because that's effectively a tax subsidy. And in my view, those were factored in, those were the use of that. Are those factored in? Is it a part of the observation? And the question is, that those gaps between the different types of employment, do they take account of the tax subsidy in the form of the deduction, for example, for national insurance contribution that employers receive, which reduces the net cost?
So in other words, the idea that if the employer is paying out a bigger expense, then clearly today they'll pay 20% less of it because they'll pay less corporation tax, and in a few years' time, 17% subsidy through all of that.
Correct.
I suspect that amounts the same thing, don't you think? If you pay a bigger expense, obviously you'll get a bigger deduction. Pay a smaller expense, you'll get a smaller deduction. I'm not sure that's a massive difference in principle.
Sure, it depends on the cost of the exchequer. Just to say, if you pay 100,000 NI as a company, you get tax relief on that. And simply the question was, do these slides reflect that?
The way I did the calculations was to say, take £100, what can you do with it? So if you're going to pay, use that £100 to pay somebody that's self-employed, you spend a lot, so that's even going to fall. A full deduction for that. If you're going to pay somebody who's an employee, first of all you have to take off the 13.87 you need to pay, and then you distribute the rest, and you'll get a full deduction for that. If you're not paying salary at all, then you're extracting dividends, then you will pay corporation tax on the profit, and then you distribute the post-tax dividend. So they all compare like by starting from 100 at the top.
That's very sad.
Thank you, Bill. It's time to meet for a corporation last year. If I could be in the last year, I was going to make a break from when I went on to a little very massive dissertation in usual markets and research and analysis that's been done on this subject over the past few years. HMRC and the Treasury itself produced a very impressive lengthy document in 2007 on the subject. But obviously things have moved on since then. What I wanted to comment briefly on was the fact that the one thing that the analysis didn't touch on is the advice that's gone to ministers on these issues. And you've been head of HMRC policy on the structure of income tax and national insurance for a period of 7 years. I had the unfortunate misfortune then to deal with this issue of tax mix alignment on at least three separate occasions. There's been no shortage of advice to ministers these subjects, as you can imagine. The three perspectives that the advice fell in could be crudely characterized as the kind of pressure from HMRC to clean up the compliance mess that's created by the complexity of the systems. From the Treasury's point of view and HMRC's point of view, there's a big issue of the erosion of the tax base, which I think the paper that Helen produced, which Paul referred to earlier, did a really impressive job of highlighting. But from the really killer issue here, it's always been the same one, which Paul touched on in his slide, which is winners and losers. Ministers, like usually prepared to turn the tax system on its head to avoid a handful of losers. When you start talking about numbers of the order that they're ordinary, they'll run a mile. And of course, Nick's, despite all its imperfections, has been a massive cash cow. And one of the ways in which ministers have been able to reduce the corporation tax rates and offer ever increasing amounts of larger personal amounts has been obviously the fact that they've imposed national insurance contributions, produced massive amounts of revenue for the government. And yet, the lapsed economist within me would say that really that employer exchange, the way it's actually collected and paid by the employer, is actually a reflection of something which is being withheld from employers, from employees. Because you know, when an employer is making calculations to hire staff, they're actually taking that into account. And absent that charge, it's possible that a larger amount of that money would find a way into the hands of employees. I don't think any amount of analysis can convince ministers to make differences here in terms of the system, because it serves many, many key stakeholders at the moment. And I think the key is going to boil down to being able to address the crucial issue that ministers worry about, which they'll be even more worried about in the light of what's happening with the budget. How do you actually tackle the issue of winners and losers?
I won't go back to this employee national insurance bit, because it seems to me that if you're looking at fairness, most people would say fairness should be roughly equal takeover pay. That maybe you look at fairness as far as working is concerned. Whereas apparently if you look at fairness as a portion of tax taken from each category. And I'm sort of wondering why, because it seems to me that employer tax insurance is in reality a payroll tax that's been hypothecated to the NHS. And as such, I don't think it ought to come into quote at all. If anything, it's a completely different question as to how much tax you should raise for businesses and which way you should raise it.
The reason that I think employer mix should be in there, and it's for exactly the kind of reason that Sam was just pointing out, which is that I think you're right that we care about the resources that individuals have left to take home. There's no reason to care about businesses per se, we only ever care about individuals. But the fact that employer mix is there does affect individuals in at least two ways. So firstly, if the employer mix charge is there, I'm less likely to want to employ somebody in the first place. I'm more likely to employ a self-employed person, contract with a self-employed person. So because of employer mix, fewer jobs will exist, if you like. And when those jobs do exist, I expect wages to be reflected. So employer mix know that, you know, I'm not handing over employer mix, IFS is handing it over. But I suspect that if there was no such thing as employer mix, I'd probably get higher wages. So I think we do care about employer mix, not because the businesses are handing it over, but because it affects people's wages at the end of the day. So that's why it's in those charts, because I think it's completely right to see employer's mix as a tax on that job, in a way that corporation tax isn't, for example.
But if you look at the fee that has all been put in charge, he's not going to charge a higher fee because he doesn't have the
Well, of course, if he's not, he's got a bad business model. I mean, he should be able to charge a higher fee because he hasn't got to pay that tax. There are market imperfections, but in general, we think that should be adjustable.
I'm just going to add that one of the ideas developed in the paid on income tax mix was the idea of moving to a single employer charge on payroll costs. So perhaps at apprenticeship level, employers' national insurance contributions sort of wrapped in together in an employer level on payroll costs.
Although obviously the OTS work did highlight the difference between, you know, small number of very high paid workers and large number of low paid workers, and moving to a payroll cost.
Sorry, I'm a corporate sole practitioner. I've been involved with it for so long that I was actually involved in the case that caused the law to be changed to telephone kiosk. I've also sat on all the panels that Sam referred to on tax and economic. Plus a few more sets of sound. there were a number of points made there. Robert, I think, made the point about employee mix supporting the NHS. Nick's paying about 22, 23 million to the NHS, and employee mix about 70 million. Big number. And it goes to the philosophy of the Nick's group. Back into the business of time and beverage and so on. We don't have time for that, but it's a lot more than just the NHS. The tool that Mark mentioned, I put myself through it, just to test drive it. It told me I need only 35, despite the fact that I might work for 7 or 8 clients in a week. It's not working. It doesn't ask some of the right questions. There's an important point, I think, on the costs of being self-employed, or the costs of being a contractor, that I haven't really been touched on. All the people who are going to be working as PSC contractors in the public sector after the 1st of April or 6th of April will have extra costs. Government departments have been telling their contractors to put their prices up by 30% to compensate them for the extra costs they are going to incur because they're going to be suffering PMI and national insurance deductions. I'm not sure that's been factored into any of them. Benefit analysis for the change in the law on Chapter 10. So this is an immensely complex area, as we've already heard from all the speakers and all the contributions from the floor. I'm glad I'm going to have to agree about it.
Okay, so I'll just pick on one of those points, and I'm going to break some bad news to both David and Robert, that NICS isn't hypothecated in any meaningful sense. So I know people think of it like that, and often the government doesn't help us understand that, but it's just money goes into a big general pot, and it gets spent on whatever the government fancies spending it on. So there is no longer any link between how much is in that pot and how much goes to the NHS or roads or anything else. So that link is gone. I'll leave others to pick on the IR35 stuff.
Can I just comment on the status tool, it cannot possibly work because it cannot possibly reflect what would go on in the mind of a judge. There is no way. And I remember when it was first being designed, as being asked to help the IT people who were working on it, and I remember them talking to me about the flow and the logic flow and so on, and I just remember that I thought then it was impossible. But the point I really want to make is that we shouldn't be trying to make that test, that cliff-edge test, better, because we are never going to make it certain. I'm sorry, Paul, but we are never going to know about it. Unless we know what we're trying to do with it. Do we want people to pay tax for NIC, or do we not want to? And you know, in some circumstances, just going to be unreasonable. We cannot actually have a system where every individual householder has to operate PAYE for every cleaning person. But if Nick is working for a very large office cleaner, then that's going to be different. And we actually have to think about what it is we're trying to do rather than trying to keep developing a better and better test. And I am concerned that the Taylor Review is very fixated on developing a better and better test, and it isn't going to work.
So we won't have a legal definition in your review.
I think we will have a number of definitions depending on what it is we're trying to do.
I just want to ask briefly, what does the panel think about this type of U-turn, and what it as a signal, what will it do in the next year or so to people moving into the gig economy? And ironically, will it erode the tax base even quicker than the original policy intention.
Well, I'm going to ask Paul Johnson to answer that. Since I think I've read him already on the subject.
Seriously?
Yes. Well, I don't think so.
Obviously the U-turn was unfortunate. It's very interesting because it's the first time I've seen a U-turn accompanied by the Chancellor making the U-turn, saying I still think it was exactly the right policy and I would do it next time, which is essentially what he said. I mean, the reasons for it are clearly political, because there was a small majority and the presumption that it wouldn't be gotten past the backbenchers. I think this the clear problem underlying it was the ludicrous manifesto pledged not to increase any of the major taxes, VAT, income tax, or NI. Well, if you're going to tie your hands for 5 years, not increasing taxes which raise two-thirds of your revenue, particularly when you know that none of them is actually quite perfect at the point at which you make the pledge, you are going to run yourself into problems. But I agree with your sort of general point. I mean, this is going to create more problems down the line. It's going to create political problems because clearly, if Jeremy Paxman or his successor will be asking Philip Hammond or his successor as we come to the next election, so will you increase national insurance? Of course, no answer will come forth, but at some point someone will feel the need to say, no, we won't. And I think finally beyond that, I think, you know, this there is a worry here that this raises, makes it to you. People who didn't previously know that there was a big tax advantage to being self-employed will now work it out. And so it may have the effect that people are referring to. So yes, there's not much good news there.
Excellent. Sorry for that.
Should we not be looking at the reasons why employers, particularly in the gig economy, go such lengths to avoid employment rights and pay tax rather than just focusing on the tax of the individual?
So I assume that sort of by definition on those, you know, the business model works on paying the gigs. So if in fact workers, if in fact the individuals are workers, and then they are subject to maximum wage, you're kind of paying for idle time as they're sort of sitting around waiting for the next job. So it means they have to, we'll have to adopt a different business model. That would be one thing.
I guess people only want food delivered at lunchtime and evening. Who knows?
Sorry. One aspect of this whole problem to be discussed is aspect of PR, which I mean, the reversal of the NI change is just seems to me like sort of next in a chain of perfectly sound tax measures that have been sort of killed by sort of uninformed tabloid rant. So, I mean, another feature is that the ones that seem to be sort of killed by the tabloids seem to be the simple ones, which seems to sort of suggest there'll be plenty of work for Mr. Walton over the coming years. Do you think as a result of this, it's a good thing that a former chancellor is now sort of taking over a newspaper and
Well, should we ask ourselves if he's going to be employed or something?
Well, I guess picking up on the PR point, I think it comes back to something that Sam was saying earlier about how do we go forward with proper reform from here. And I think probably part of the challenge is going to be packaging up policies together in a way that make them, you know, feasible. I think it's interesting that the government gave more beneficial pension rights to self-employed a couple of years ago. We saw a cut to Class 2 NICs last year. So by trying to give away at one point and take away at another point, it makes it harder to sell. So arguably, you should have shoved some of those things together. My guess is that going forward, we'll have to not just do one little policy at a time, but more do what Judith and I think Sam were hinting at and think about what is the package of measures, who are the winners and losers, can we do things in combination that make them, you know, more sellable to the comrades, poll type people who, you know, feel certain ways about certain things. So I'm sure there is a big PR issue.
The curious thing about the NI thing is that the winners, actually, if you consider them a huge sum of money, it's going to be raised somewhere else. I mean, the winners are hugely outnumbered by the losers. So, for the people who are benefiting, it's a victory. It would pile with Leicester City winning the championship, practically, isn't it?
Mary.
Thanks, Mary Moffris. So, firstly, thank you, everyone. I think you articulated, all of you, really well the problem we have. The anomaly, the infections, the fact that actually our data is something to change. My comment actually was going to be very similar starting point to Sam's, actually, the gentleman just now, which is but the actual practical issue of how do you start from here, and the political difficulty, the PR difficulty. Paul, I think your job's going to be a big PR job. And I think, obviously, that indicated by what happened with the turnaround last week. which I was very saddened by because I feel that there has to be change. And picking up on what you just talked about, how do we achieve that change? So maybe there's something about how do we as institutions, as government, help to bring the country together to realise what the problem is. I absolutely agree with what you said about let's work out why you're doing this. Now, it could be fairness. I don't think you'll get everyone to agree on what fairness is even in this room. For me, the bigger problem we have is where are our tax revenues going to come from, and is there an erosion of tax revenues over the long term? And for me, this debate is really important, but it's part of a much wider debate. So what about the other anomalies? Is it right that we can rely on earned taxes from people, whether they're self-employed or employed in the longer term? What about the anomaly between earned income and unearned income? And of course, there's a big difference there in investment income between those who are on pensions struggling with the very low interest rates from banks versus those who have multi-millions invested. So for me, this is a really difficult problem. We have a technical arm of government about how do we get as a country, we've pulled together really well in things like world wars. How do we as a country come together to understand what this problem is and understand that there will be losers? Bundling them together, I think even more widely, Helen, than you were alluding to, I think it's going to be the only way to do it.
Yeah, I think that's tough. I mean, I think you're right. This is a problem right at the heart of the tax system in some ways, and it's one thing we've pointed out at IFS for a long time, is that we're talking about individuals and how they work, but of course we're comparing them to individuals who run companies, so then you get into issues around how corporation tax, capital gains tax, dividend taxation, and it's very, very hard to isolate just one bit of the tax system and think, I'll just fix that. And then you get into all sorts, you basically get into the whole tax system. So I suspect we can't have an IFS style, let's redesign the tax system overnight, as much as we'd love that. So we probably do have to think about what is a more manageable chunk of that. How can we take something that's a bit more manageable? And I think a good place to start would be to let's try and set out a vision for where we'd like to be. We're never going to get there overnight. I think everyone agrees on that. If we could set out, kind of articulate what the issues are. And you're right, no one's ever going to agree on that it's just one issue. There'll be a range of issues like the revenue, the fairness. If we can sort of articulate what the issues are and set out where we'd like to be, and then think about the practical, how do we get there? I guess what I'd quite like to see. I don't know how realistic that is.
Obviously, as an academic, I would say the same thing, but and casting about for some sort of silver lining in Brexit, perhaps if things are so disastrous and we really need revenue so badly that people might see that there needs to be a change.
Brexit's not a change.
but I do think that looking at it all together and then trying to have a bigger debate and bringing in, I would say, capital gains tax and so on as well has to come in. It may sound impossible, but actually I think we've reached the point where that is the only way forward.
People won't understand otherwise.
And people do. I had my son-in-law sent me the most wonderful pet screenshot from his Twitter from a sports club where people had been discussing this issue of the U-turn, and they totally understood that they were mostly employees and they were going to be paying more. They totally understood it, and I think people are underestimated by the press, and if anyone really tried to explain it in the press, they would perfectly well understand what was going on.
It is very interesting that sometimes now they're taking the time to have the conversation, because month before accounting firms organised what they called a citizen's jury to look at some aspects of the tax system. And they took the time with the selection of ordinary people, not tax experts at all, not necessarily business people, but just ordinary people. And they spent some time explaining some aspects of the tax system. They had in the end a very high quality conversation covering everything from inheritance tax to the design of income tax, through just taking the time to explain some of the fundamental principles and helping people to develop their thinking.
Tina. This is actually what is going on. I thought I'd do the research on the way here, and not having done much before that. So I asked my taxi driver what he thought about all this. And he was actually very informed. He was quite opposed to the U-turn that the Chancellor had taken. He, even though he's self-employed, he thought the self-employed should be paying more. In fact, he thought everybody should be paying a bit more in tax because of the way the economy is going and the fact we're all getting older, the health service is struggling. He thought at least the penny should go on income tax, self-employed national insurance should go up, and he thought people should not shop, stop moaning about it and just get on with it. And if he was Chancellor, that's what he would do. So, I was wondering, if you were Chancellor, obviously after this Parliament, what one thing or two things that he came up with would you do?
I'm not going to pretend to be the Chancellor, but I do want to touch on one very interesting observation from the SDS review of income tax and national insurance contributions, which is that quite a significant number of people say that they would be prepared to pay a little bit more for a system which was inherently simpler and more intuitive. Now, what I don't know is how much more they would be prepared to pay, and whether it feels like a good answer when asked in a questionnaire. I wouldn't feel like such a good answer when the tax bill comes at the end of the year, but it does seem to be an issue which is worth exploring a bit further. How much do people value certainty, simplicity, and intuitive answers in terms of the overall level of tax bill?
Sorry, So, I mean, just on the PR, aren't there two or three simple charts, one of which you showed up there, which we talk about for the next 5 years? There might be another one in terms of gains tax, but it just makes it very simple and clear. And as we've heard in the audience, a lot of people understand quite a bit already. I like that chart.
Well, we'll keep showing it.
I don't know why, it used to be in the press.
And your wonderful films, which you should.
Yeah, and we have videos, yeah, watch our videos.
Explaining tax, which everybody should be promoting.
Right.
Hi. Thanks, everyone. What a fantastic debate and how interesting. The one bit I slightly wanted to disagree with Julius on was about the understanding. I think people do understand that they're paying in, but I think there's, and partly some political issues, there's a lack of understanding of the benefits part of it. And so many people say, yes, the self-employed do pay less, but they get so much less back. And I think that is a widely held view.
When I said people understand, I mean they're capable of understanding, and we actually have to get that out. And if I had been Chancellor making that announcement, I think that I would have tried to explain some of those things rather than talking at quite a lot of length about fairness and so on. I would have tried to explain exactly what I meant with some examples. And like Paul's Nick, you know, I think they should have been in the budget speech, and then maybe people would have been happy.
There may be an opportunity, because there was an announcement that parental benefits would be reviewed. And so I think that could be an opportunity to then revisit this, because, you know, when people understand that they get back for what they pay, in fact, there's a golden opportunity for some PR there, and hopefully you could then revisit it.
And that's why I think we're going to have a whole review around saying that it has to somehow be tied up with the tax and everything, and the benefits. And really presented well, and that's where the PR will come in.
I think it's a shame tax isn't part of the Taylor Review, of course.
Well, I think the ICAEW said it should be, but I don't think the Taylor Review, as currently constituted, would be equipped to do the tax part. So, but I see no reason why they can't all work together in some way.
Hello, Fiona Bell, RSM. We've been speaking about rates and status and things like that, but I was also quite interested in quantum and also in how you deal with cash investment that different individuals might make as employees or non-employees. And I was thinking in particular of your example of Nick the cleaner. If he is an employee, the cost of his mop will not be deductible, but if he's a non-employee, the cost of his mop will be deductible. And that's a kind of like an issue looking at the risk of returns and those kind of issues, and how you think that aspect should be addressed, because it's not just the rates, it's the amount on which people are being taxed.
Yeah,
I think we completely agree. Yeah, the tax base matters loads, and it's always surprising how much attention gets given to tax rates and not worrying about the tax base. So, you know, one of the big differences between employees and self-employed, people running their own business, is this issue about investment. And I think ideally, you know, if I had their way, we would try to change the tax base to ensure that kind of the cost of investment was fully deductible from the tax base, so that you don't distort people's decisions over how much to invest, or how many mocks to buy, for example, or whatever else it is they're buying. And then there's an issue about benefit, about expenses more generally, and the rules for employees and self-employed, and yeah, they're different. Can we make them less different? But yeah, the tax base matters.
I mean, if we really used making taxes, and we really moved away towards having proper returns for everybody, which we should be able to do with digitalisation, then we could change the rules so that people could deduct it. But I'm sure that we only have the strict rules we have because of the alignment.
Chris, and then.
Thank you, and thank you all for such a good debate. I guess when I reflect on this, we're in this discussion a lot because we're talking about, from a gig economy, someone who could either be employed or argue that they are self-employed and therefore shift from one part to another. Yet, when we think about this, we seem to not draw a distinction between the self-employed individual and the unincorporated business. And I wonder if there is a distinction in your mind between that person who's running an unincorporated business, maybe the corner shop with a number of employees to this, or is there not? Is it just as minute a difference we're talking about the employee or self-employed, or is there a scale here that we need to think more widely than just the comparison to a certain chart to something which effectively is a business tax implicit within our income tax system, rather than something that is a question about how I'm going to tax the returns of an individual from his own activities, his or her own activities, just on their own.
John, there are some very interesting questions here, and the OTS has looked in detail at whether or not we should provide alternative mechanisms for people who run slightly larger businesses. So why is it that in some countries, there are very large numbers of slightly larger businesses which may or may not be incorporated, but which are treated as look-through from a tax point of view, very familiar with the US system, for example. Should there be forms of doing business that provide some degree of protection for the owner, perhaps a slightly larger business, which is maybe taking a few more risks, but in which that person can still be taxed as an individual rather than an incorporated entity? So I don't see a lot of these questions have been looked at in quite a bit of detail. It's clear that there are no simple answers, as ever, but we're worth looking at further.
I will just add to that. I can see a big difference between the incorporated sole trader, one who's got big growth plans, one's taken the lease by the business perhaps, but I can't really see much difference between the sole trader that's not doing that. It's just choosing incorporation because it's got a different tax rate than tax rate. It's a little bit before that.
Sorry.
I recently voted an idea that any employer, using that phrase loosely, that enters into a labour only arrangement should not get corporation tax relief for that deduction, for that payment, unless the payment's made under BAYE. So change the whole emphasis so that the employer is penalised for entering into, shall we say, sham arrangements or dubious arrangements. I just wondered what the panel thought of that crazy idea. Secondly, I just wonder, this evening, having heard you all, whether really, given that we have an independent Bank of England, we really should have an independent tax commission, independent of government, because government aren't capable or trustworthy enough of dealing with these matters. Again, I've asked the panel, who are not civil servants, to come in.
Well, I propose that we should do, and I was laughed out of court. I mean, it's not going to happen that we're going to have an independent commission. Tax is just not going to be handed over. But I do think that we could have a. The Office of Tax Simplification is great as far as it goes, but I think it could be boosted considerably, giving all a lot more power. And and a bigger staff, and, you know, time to do things properly. And that's probably the best we're going to get from that. But and being really independent, so with initiating its own inquiries. But the idea that we're going to have a great royal commission which is going to change the whole system would be lovely, but it doesn't seem very likely.
So I understand that the Office of Tax was created as an independent office of the Treasury, charged with providing advice to the Chancellor and providing tax system, but we are in a position whereby we can identify areas which we feel should be looked at and to offer views on those areas. So we're not restricted to responding to requests from the Chancellor for research in particular areas, and we have done that and we'll continue to do that. And we'll also produce at least two kinds of output, if you like, one being the thoroughly researched 180-page report looking in great detail with the help of external stakeholders, and the other being a shorter focus paper to shed light on an area that requires a little bit more thought. So I think with that, there's a great deal that can be done, and I'd certainly very much welcome thoughts, contributions from everyone really as to what we should be looking at and how we should be doing it.
Very much. On that positive note, I think it's time to go for a drink. So may I thank all our speakers very much indeed for their great contribution, and indeed you, the audience, or your questions and general participation. I'm going to take away something I never thought I'd say, that the importance of VAT. I'm really taken by Julie's point that the threshold is far too high. So that.